Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome athletic trainer and founder and president of Sports Medicine Consultants, Chris Troianos. Chris is an entrepreneur who has served as a medical director and coordinator for several athletic events. As the medical coordinator to the Boston Athletic Association, he is the architect for the medical coverage provided at the Boston Marathon. He has over 48 years' experience when it comes to the medical care and public safety for a number of endurance events. He is a sought-after lecturer on the subject of healthcare for large-scale athletic events and has extensive experience working with local, state, and federal agencies as it relates to mass casualty concerns for major marathons. Chris has an excellent track record when providing road race medicine as a result of his many years as the medical coordinator of the Boston Marathon. From 1977 to 1995, he has volunteered as the coordinator of athletic training services for the Boston Athletic Association. Since 1996, he has taken on a leadership role organizing a medical committee of over 50 medical professionals and another 1,800 on-site medical volunteers. He has been the primary liaison to the various cities and towns supporting the race. His partnerships and relationships building skills have created strong ties with the Department of Public Health, the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, and 10 participating hospitals. His ability to bring people together and forge relationships has truly allowed a number of competing agencies to act as one during this historic marathon. Now, on to the show.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast with Chris Troianos. I was introduced to Chris as a sophomore athletic training student from Northeastern University, and he showed me what it was like to become an athletic trainer my first semester as clinical student. I felt like he was going to be a great guest to come on and talk about the marathon and his path as an athletic trainer. So, Chris, thanks for coming on. I know you're a busy man, and like to hear a little bit about your background as an athletic trainer and where you are today.
Well, Andrew, again, thank you for the opportunity. It's great to be with you and the audience. You know, when you go back when we first met, again, that was a long time ago, and a lot has changed, and we've come a long way, but achieved so much. So it's kind of nice to be able to reflect and look back. You know, as you know, I'm a certified athletic trainer. I've been one since, I think, 1979. When I first started at Babson College, I became licensed in, I think, 81 or something of that nature. But, you know, been pretty much in the college ranks for a long period of time. For, I think, about 26 or 27 years. And then a couple of years, two or three, at LaSalle College. A little stop in between doing some fundraising at Children's Hospital. Obviously, for the most part, I've been working as the director of a company called Sports Medicine Consultant.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it shows kind of the evolution of what athletic trainers, you know, kind of go through, being on the front lines of practice, working into consulting, and then moving forward into other phases of their life. Just because you're not practicing on the sideline doesn't mean you can't, you know, provide that care by consulting and helping others. So it's great to see that you're still involved this late in your career.
I appreciate that. I think, you know, I look back to my early part, and again, before I even became a certified athletic trainer, I don't know if you remember the old Kramer clinics. So that's where I first got introduced to it. Well, I knew what I wanted to do, and I knew I wanted to go to Northeastern University. So Kramer had a clinic in the summer. He had basically what I think you and I would consider the all-stars of athletic training at his time, between Jack Baines, Coco, Frank George, Dick Malacre. I keep going. I mean, just absolutely outstanding athletic training. And I remember during the first lecture, the evening that we got there, it was Frank Joy. And Frank really downplayed basically what it was like to be an athletic trainer in the sense that, you know, if you weren't into traveling a lot of hours, probably not getting paid a lot, this wasn't the profession for you. And that the discussion of not getting paid a lot really stuck with me because I didn't want to have to struggle and have a profession that I loved and not be able to raise a family. And, you know, I go back and I ever see Frank George at conventions and the like, I thank him for that comment because that really motivated me. I think you'd agree that, you know, and I don't mind saying this, that I am definitely what I would consider a non-traditional athletic trainer. Granted, yeah, 25, 26 years at Babson of College, but I'll be honest with you, I got bored really easy.
Yeah.
You know, standing on the sidelines, practices, games, I mean, loved it, don't get me wrong. But I was always looking for that what up. And, you know, back then, you know, I was doing things like I became the athletic department photographer. Well, we got a digital camera and I started taking pictures of all the athletic games while I was covering the game. Kept me good. Then eventually I morphed into fundraising. So I started to become the fundraiser for the athletic department. And then eventually became the assistant athletic director and then moved into fundraising a little bit more in depth. So again, it was my ADD of athletic training. I just couldn't sit still and I wanted to do something different, which eventually led to the consulting.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you say that because I remember kind of vividly going through Northeastern and Chad Starkey, our director at Northeastern at that time. He said, you have to love it for what it's worth and what you provide for athletes every single day of the week. And you're going to be working long hours and you're going to work weekends and you're going to work holidays. For me, it resonated because I really wanted to get into medicine at some level. And a new athlete training was it for me just because I liked working with the active individual. And then, you know, meeting you and meeting Jamie Musler and meeting Emma over at Harvard and having those experiences through my undergraduate career kind of sparked me to want to learn and do more. And then I got, you know, being in your facility, working with you and Dominic Solfaro back in the day is how I got my start at sports and PT because Dominic was working for Carl and Craig. And Dominic and I bumped into each other at an EATA when I was a senior. And he said to me, hey, what are you doing after graduation? I said, I've got to look for a job. He's like, well, we're hiring an AT. Why don't you apply? And that's how I got my start. And fast forward 30 years later, I'm in the same clinic, different company, but I'm still rooted in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and I'm still working for the town of Weston. So for me, it was definitely a good experience. And I, you know, I wouldn't pass it up for anything in the world. I think it's a great career.
No, it is. But I think, would you not agree that, and I'm going to throw this on our profession, the NATA, and maybe some of the old guard, that we had to accept it. And I think we would both agree that you don't have to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
There are other ways to do this, to do it well. And I think that that approach, in my opinion, held us back for too long and is still holding us. You know, again, you go into what the BOC has done and the NATA has done in regards to saying to new athletic trainers, you have to go to a doctorate level. You know, I don't know how you feel about it, but I've been against that from day one. I think it's a total mistake.
And yeah.
You know, you do that, you're spending all this extra money, but you're coming out and still making $40,000, $45,000, $50,000 and killing yourself.
Yeah, no, I have to agree. I have one student, former student that went back to get his DAT. And I haven't spoken to him yet on his thought process on if that's helped him or not. And quite frankly, I can tell just like looking at salaries that depending on where you are, it's probably not gonna elevate because you know, you think about it, it all comes down to the funding that the university or college, high school, professional level team has for you as an athletic trainer. But it's, I think, in most part, it's being able to communicate your value and show your value to that organization to be able to get more money. And I think as we get more seasoned or become better at our craft, we can do that. And then, you know, hopefully demand more. But it's going to take, and it's still taking a lot of time. And a lot of that is, I think there's a lot of, you know, legislation restriction too within certain states, which also holds back some of the care that you can provide, which is, you know, as you know, it's been going on for years and years and years and years.
Well, again, if you agree, there was for a long period of time when we were young, when we were in the middle part of our career, the supply and demand, there was a ton of that for them, right? And, you know, either you accepted a $32,000 a year job or someone else did. And, you know, granted, I understand what the BOC and the NIT did to try to reduce some of the curriculum programs. I think a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of good ones went, you know, out the door. I mean, Northeastern, BU being two of them. I'm really shocked that particularly BU is no longer with us. It's too bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, there has to be a better approach. And I don't know what the answer is, but it's getting better. Don't get me wrong. But if a young student said to me, I want to go into medicine, my options are AT, PT, PA. What would you recommend? I'd have a little hesitancy in recommending being an AT.
Yeah, I think it goes back to, I think, you know, you hit it earlier on what's the value and the salary that's involved given what you're giving for care and what you're providing day in and day out. I've had a couple students that have gone on to AT, high school students, and they went back and got PT and went back to medical school. So it's kind of paved the way for them to see if they really like medicine. I think it's an expensive way to find out if you like medicine, though. I mean, we have our daughter just finished undergrad, not an AT. She went for speech language, but that's a pretty hefty price to try to pave your way. But I guess there's a little bit of work to do on NATA side, but also for us to advocate for ourselves. And hopefully the younger generations are advocating better than we did, or at least they're being heard better than we were to help out.
I mean, I'm to be honest with you, I'm worried about the profession's future. I really am.
Yeah, I feel the same way, but I'm hoping that it's going to be better than what we're seeing, because there's a lot of us that are, you know, in our career that we may be retiring in the next 10 years or so, right? And then what's coming up, you know, the ranks, and can they cover where we have, you know, over 600 high schools in Massachusetts alone, and there isn't enough athletic trainers for those where there should be, right? So I think that's definitely another discussion we need to bring forth the powers to be able to figure out how.
Nothing we're going to solve today, Andrew, but I think right. We all can see the problems.
So moving on to Marathon, I think this is one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk to you a little bit more in detail. I had 1 year that I volunteered for the Marathon, and then I was wrapped up in my profession being in a public school. We have stuff over the vacation weeks. Can you describe a little bit into the planning of the Marathon and what goes into that, and give people a better idea? Like, it seems like it's a year-long process, right? Or is it something that's 6 months? I mean, the amount of people you have to get to volunteer, the amount of process of getting things donated for the Marathon, how to make sure that you're caring for the athlete that's running the Marathon. Can you go into a little bit of detail about how that works?
Well, even in a little detail, it's amazing the multitude of layers. I know your podcast isn't that long, but it is so many layers. It is a year-round planning process. You know, not 24/7, but, you know, there's a lot happening. And obviously the 6 months leading up to it are pretty intense. But, you know, to give you an idea what I do as the medical coordinator. So I am contracted by the Boston Athletic Association to manage all of their events. So it's four events. It's the 5K, the marathon, 10K and a half. And they're my biggest contract from the company Sports Medicine. So everything that happens, particularly at the marathon and those other events, falls under my domain. With that, I have, much like as we do with any of the high school college jobs that we've had, we have our medical directors, and I report before them. So it's still the same setup as we would in the normal traditional setup. But, you know, as we know, physicians don't have time to get into the minutiae of all the planning and meetings and everything that goes on with it. So I've got really four outstanding physicians that I work with. Then we have a medical committee. That medical committee is, I'd say, close to 70 people strong. They represent people like Larry Venus, who is my athletic training coordinator. I've got David Nolan, my PT coordinator. I've got people that are in charge of all the docs, nurses. But then I have other subsets of people that are dealing with medical records, medical security. I can keep going. It's just a multitude of different individuals that have a slice of the pie, and that's their domain, and they report to me. And it's a big effort. And to be honest with you, every one of these individuals, including the medical directors, are all volunteers.
Right, right. Which is amazing that they've taken time out of their regular schedule to volunteer, but the importance of that and how that impacts the runner, right, that's running that race to make sure that they're safe at all aspects and all, you know, miles of the race.
I think, Andrew, you might agree that what helps me is I'm representing a tremendous plan. The Boston Marathon, the BAA. And, you know, look, it's the most iconic marathon in the world. So with that, knowing how to leverage that brand to the advantage of what we're trying to achieve and to achieve our goals is something I don't have any hesitancy in using. And it works well, and people want to be involved.
Yeah, that's great. I think, you know, I was at a conference last August, a year ago, and it was actually probably the end of June, so almost about a year ago. And the Corey Stringer Institute was running the conference on, you know, we were going over a bunch of different policy, but one of them was heat illness and how to treat heat illness. And the standard of care, obviously, is cold immersion, rectal thermometry to cool the athlete properly and in the correct amount of time and get them when they're down to temperature off to the hospital or walking out of the tents, basically. And in the high school athletic realm, it's been like this, no, like this, you shouldn't be doing that. And honestly, we sat down and we said, no, this is the common practice. This is what we're going to implement. And we brought them in. And this was one of the reasons why, because you do it all day long in the marathon. Every road race does this now. It's standard of care. The NATA calls it the standard of care for treating heat illness. And what are we doing? We're seeing young kids that are working out in hot weather, football players, college track athletes, and they're not being cared for. It's just like if you were going to, you know, administer an AED for someone and going into cardiac arrest. Just because they're a female on a field, are you going to not use an AED? You're obviously going to make sure that it's everything safe around them and protect them so people can't see what's happening, but you're still going to administer that care. So we actually wrote that policy in, and we now that's our common practice because we know that that's the best for the athlete. So for you, as you know, the coordinator of the marathon, what role does the ATC, like if someone like me was coming to work for you, what is my role? Are there different delegations within that? How do you manage that? And how are they taking care of the athlete coming in off the course?
So, you know, I think you knew this, is that when you look at our medical volunteer base, it's a multidisciplinary base. Doctors, nurses, EMTs, I keep calling PTs, athletic training. And we design our protocols to obviously fit the need of the event. And they act as our standards of care. But we also make sure as we're designing those protocols, they fit within the standards of care of the volunteer and what your license will allow you to do. So, you know, with that, as an athletic trainer and our role delineations, you can do ice immersions, you can do rectal thermometers, and all of our athletic trainers are pretty much involved in that, if need be. So that's how we kind of delineate. Now, you know, it might not be the same for an EMT or a paramedic, but a nurse or a doctor can all do rectal thermometer. Not difficult to do. I mean, if you haven't done it, I mean, granted, there's a little bit of a sheepish factor. I mean, you know, do I really want to do this? But once you understand that it is a medical emergency and what you're doing is saving someone's life, you know, then it becomes a little bit more acceptable. I can't tell you how many times I've done either rectal thermometers or done ice immersions. I don't think Doug might agree with this, but I think I've probably done more than Doug has in his group. You know, tomorrow I'm speaking at the American College of Sports Medicine. And a lot of it's got to do with the marathon and the program, but also I'm talking about climate change and how climate change has really impacted the athletic fields, endurance medicine, and all of that. And the fact that we're seeing so many more heat illnesses. And I have a slide in here that I put up. It was four events. So it was the BAA 10K in June, I had to beach the Beacon in August, first week in August up in Maine. Falmouth Road Race 2 weeks after that, and then the Cambridge Half Marathon in November. Out of those four events, 72 exertional beach runs. In four events, the highest being the 112.2.
Wow. Pretty amazing.
It absolutely is to see that many in a four event span, where so many athletic trainers might see one, two, maybe.
Correct.
One.
Yep. Yep.
And that's why Doug and a lot of us recommend that if you can ever get to Falmouth as an athletic trainer, that's a living lab. I mean, we did 40 that year.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And then how many of those athletes, just to give the listeners an idea, how many of those walked out of the tent versus going to the hospital?
Large percentage.
Yeah.
At Falmouth, 1 year that we had the 40, I think we transported six.
Yeah.
And that's the overall goal when we design these medical programs is that, look, we want to be able to do what we can on site and not be an impact to the local EMS or hospitals or the general public. And if I'm sending 30, I mean, just this past Boston Marathon, we had 40 exertional hospitals. If I'm sending all 40 of those to the hospital, it's not really the goal that we have in mind.
Right, right. And then you're overloading the emergency department. And are they actually getting the treatment they need? And they're probably not because they're not set up for it.
Well, but the answer we've in all the events that I work on, Andrew, is that we reach out to the hospital. Mm-hmm. So we have great relationships with nine different hospitals, four in the course, five in Boston. We work with their emergency rooms. We work with the emergency preparedness coordinators. And we share our protocol. And in many a case, they'll ask us for an isomergent tub or, you know, like Datatherms or whatever we have. And they've adopted our protocols for that event, but then have adopted those protocols for other events that we're not involved in.
Yeah, which is good.
It is very good.
Now, speaking of Datatherm, it's hard to get your hands on one these days. I was talking to Colin Sports Medicine about it, trying to get mine, and I ordered mine a year ago. And I'm still waiting for it. So she, you know, Carol was telling me that, no, you should have it by this July, hopefully. So fingers crossed.
I got for the marathon, I ordered 20 extra.
Yeah.
I got the 20, but no probe.
Yeah. And that's what she said. The hard part, I think it's coming. Is it they build them in Sweden, but they're bringing them here or vice versa? Yeah.
It's either Sweden or Germany. And there's been a supply chain issues. And there's a company called RG Medical out of the Midwest.
Well, maybe we should build our own. What do you think?
You know, Andrew, we've looked into it, you know, to figure out how can we reverse engineer it because there just is no good alternative. I think that when I talked to RG Medical, there's only one group that has more data therms than I do, and that's the U.S. government.
Yeah, I'm sure for all the military.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I'm the second largest owner of the probes and the thermometers. You know, I think we've got roughly around 60 to 65.
Well, I may be calling you to borrow one before the marathon.
Happy to help.
Hopefully not. Hopefully they'll send me mine. As far as the route, when you think of the marathon, it's, you know, 26.2 miles, right? How do you station on the route? Like, how does that look from a medical coordinator's standpoint? And are there rovers along the route? There's stations that people can, you know, drop into? How does that look?
So, you know, the route, obviously, from west to east, it's 26.2 miles, as you mentioned, but it goes through eight cities and towns. And that creates a massive challenge for me because now I'm dealing with eight different police, fire, public safety agencies, EMS agencies that have certain coverages. And each of those cities and towns will have certain requirements that I have to adjust to. But, you know, for the amount of time I've been doing this, I've got great relationships with all those chiefs. So they trust us and they won't know what we're going to do. So we have 26 medical stations along the course. They're not evenly spaced. They're more really backloaded from Wellesley into Boston. But they're situated strategically so that we can get an ambulance to and out relatively quickly. Whether it be on the north or south side of the course, because as you know, you can't cross over that course with the exception of maybe one area.
Yeah.
Which is Route 9. So we have to be able to situate them so that the ambulance, if they're going to a certain hospital, can go without impacting the course itself. The 26 stations, the smallest ones we have are 20 by 20 tents, largest are 20 by 40. They all have physicians, nurses. So what I have at the finish line, these are just smaller sub-satellites of what I have in Boston. They're able to do basically everything that we can do. Well, actually, that's not 100%. So 12 of them are IV capable.
Okay.
And our protocol is such as we don't do an IV unless we know what that blood sodium is. So they all have point of care ISTATs to determine blood chemistry. They all have AEDs, 12 leads, everything they need, and all the general supplies. Each of the 26 medical stations then has what we call proceed-out teams of two, usually an EMT paramedic, that will go east or west of that tent to roam or pick up anyone that might have gone down. They'll have a wheelchair. They can bring that individual back. Then there are a multitude of ATVs or gators out there, some that my company supplies, others are supplied by the state. And then we have public safety up and down the route.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I think that's, you know, if you think about it, like you said, you know, traveling over, you know, the marathon route's impossible. We have to shut our clinic down because nobody can get to it.
Exactly.
So that's a hard, you know, we know what it's like. So it's nice that you have the towns that are able to be your eyes and ears on the course and then get them to where they need to be. Now, you mentioned gator response. Now, it kind of leads me to the next question. Can you tell us a little bit about rapid response gators and your role with, you know, working with them with, you know, sports medicine consultants and how that has been a part of your, you know, road race or event staffing?
Well, if I could, I'll start with sports medicine consults to give folks an idea of what that is. So I started that company, I think, in the early 1980s. Because at the time I was doing camps, I needed a place to put the funding and I could do deductions when I was an LLC or was incorporated. I then started to look at these events and knew that these events needed help medically. So eventually I decided to go full bore into sports medicine consultants where we have roughly about 12 or 13 events that hire us to manage their medical program. And obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the VA being one of them. And you know, I've been doing that now for full time since 2014. And that's my sole job. The rapid response medical gators piece, one of my volunteers came to me and we had one or two John Deere gators. Retrofitted them with lights and sirens and had a couple of what we call med beds, or beds that you can put in the back. Basically joined with him and we developed the company Rapid Response. And right now we have a fleet of 5 ATVs. 4 of them are John Deere, 1 is a Can-Am. And the primary role of Rapid Response is we rent these to municipalities. So just this past weekend, 3 of them were at Boston College, where Harvard PD and EMS were using them at that. We used them at all the events that I managed and others. July 4th is a very big weekend for us without all the ATVs being rented. But then what we also do is we build these for municipalities or colleges or anyone that would like one. We built one a year and a half ago for the Patriots. So that if you're ever at the game, you see that like 4-seat John Deere. Well, we built that for Jimmy and his team based on the specs that he wanted. So we build them that we can do, whether it be a Stokes, a backboard. We could also do it with deer antlers, so you can put a striker stretcher or another type of stretcher in it. And we also now are building what we call fire suppression skids. So we had fire departments come to us and we put maybe a 30 or 50 gallon tank on it with a CBT pump and with the hose. And then, you know, that goes out into the woods to handle a small brush fire. So that's been going on for about the last 10 years.
Okay.
Still growing. We have some ups and downs, but it's a very unique company.
Yeah. I mean, we have, I have a John Deere XUV over at Weston and we have, I mean, we needed it for a bunch of different reasons. One, for transport, but we have 16 fields, pretty big complex. And we had a med bed put on it. I have a hydraulic bed lift, backboards on it. I got a seat on it. So I can put anybody on that easily and get them from a backfield to the front of the school if EMS cannot get into the backfields because the gates aren't accessible. So for us, it was definitely, it's been a game changer for us. And I've had that for, it's got to be 10, 12, at least 12 years. So it's definitely worth its weight in gold when you're dealing with athlete, you know, extraction and bringing them to where they need to be.
Question. And there are quite a few companies that make this product. There's one called Kintec up in Vermont that does a tremendous job, and they probably got the lion's share of the market out there. But what we do is we are kind of more of what I consider a boutique company that, you know, whether it be Jimmy Whalen or you or anyone else that came to us and said, well, this is what I'm looking for. Well, we can design it based on your needs. We don't do cookie cutter products in any way, shape.
Yeah. Now, if somebody is listening that wants to get a hold of you guys to be able to discuss a product, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Well, I mean, obviously, my cell phone number would be one way to do it, which I'm sure you can put up on the screen. But just look up Rapid Response Medical Gators or Sports Medicine Consultants. The numbers are there. And then once we have an understanding of what you're looking to do and the job that you want the ATV to do, then we would work with you, your school, your institution, organization to recommend, you know, the type of vehicle that you want. We're not married to just John Deere. We like John Deere. We think Can-Am is probably a better way to go. We're not a big Polaris or Ranger fan because of just some mechanical issues. But what we would do is work with the institution where you buy the vehicle. You choose it. We would work with you. But as we design it, we work to make sure that the specs of the vehicle, particularly the weight limitations between what we're doing with the bed, patient, the amount of property or materials you're putting on it, and the driver, all fit within that spec. And then it's guaranteed to work for at least 3 years.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I saw, you know, a couple of your products online, and they look pretty flashy with the diamond plate, and they look good. Mine, I might need to do a refresh on mine, so I may be calling you to come do that for me.
I think the one thing that we do, Andrew, that's different from others is that I've got this guy, Bobby Melvin, and Bob is just a magician when it comes to metal and aluminum. And what we, when we build these, we don't use popper. And if we do, everything is welded. We either bend them or weld all the seams, all the corners. So that weld is not going anywhere. And we use a thicker aluminum than what you might find with some of our competitors.
Yeah, that's great. Hopefully you get some people giving you guys a call. But if I have anybody looking, I'll be sending them your way.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
So during your service as an athlete trainer, just thinking traditional athlete training, is, you know, you can also look at the consulting piece too. Is there anything that stood out and you took a step back and thought of, hey, you know what? I'm glad I became an athletic trainer. Is there something that you did with, is someone's life you changed? Was it something within a colleague's career or peer? Anything that stands out for you over the last, I don't want to say how many years, but career?
You know, you talk about mentors, and I was extremely fortunate to have two outstanding mentors and friends. They were friends as well, Coco Kasabian and Jack Banks. They're the ones that really set me in the right path to understand what it was to be a good athletic trainer, to listen and to deal with people. You know, then getting the BAPS and, you know, people like Carl Nelson, Mike Linkovich. I can keep going. So many that, you know, when I became certified, as you know, we didn't have a really good understanding of what we needed to be. We were still pretty green. And to have that type of support when you went on the road with that type of individual, those individuals, just it really gave me a comfort level. So fast forward, I mean, and just looking at you, I mean, you were one of my students way back when. And I mean, obviously, you turned out great. I didn't screw you up.
That's right.
But you know, I'll be honest with you, and I think you might agree, Andrew, I was not the easiest guy to work for.
No, but you know what? I learned that, you know, hard work pays off, right? And the way that you had worked with athletes and the things that you taught me day one, I mean, I remember being on the soccer field at Babson, and you said, go through my medical kit and know where everything is, because if I need something, I want you to know where it is. And that was day one. And I just like, holy shit. Like, so, I mean, and you really took the time. And again, it's, I think it's a little bit of tough love with the profession, but you need to know what to do, when to do it, how to take care of the people you need to take care of, and do it so you make a difference. And if you're doing that, I think you're winning every day, which is good.
I agree. And I think, you know, looking back at my career, you asked me what the proudest moment is, and it's really kind of culmination of things. But, you know, going back to the marathon, think about this. When I first started, it was myself, John Dana for the first year. Then Brian Fitzgerald came in the year after that. So there were three athletic trainers at that event in 1977-78. Fast forward now, over 150 athletic trainers certified and students at that event.
Pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And I remember when I was working at Babson or LaSalle, and I would get resumes when we had an open position. And when you see experience, Boston Marathon was in 99% of the resumes that we received. So I love that, you know, fact that we touched so many people. I look back at the number of certified athletic trainers that come from all over the world, particularly the U.S., to come visit us. I mean, Marge Albom, Ron Corson. There's so many individuals that wanted to experience it and came for visits. But really, when you look at it, it's the students that are there now and have been for the past couple of years, that they come from distances. I mean, Ray Castle has been bringing up students from before they left Louisiana. We get people from Chicago, Washington, I mean, all over the country, where preceptors bringing their students with them to gain that experience. That to me is if I look at one thing that I am very proud of, is the fact that we've touched those students and helped them get on the pool. I don't think there's anything better.
That's amazing. I mean, you guys do a great service, and, you know, that's one thing that it's great to have that many athletic trainers helping out on a medical team to be able to provide that service to the runners. And I think it's amazing. So thank you for doing that. If you had a student that was, and we talked a little bit about the athletic training piece at the beginning, but if you had a student come to you and they were, you know, wanted to become successful in the career of athletic training, and is there something that you would pass on to them that would kind of help kickstart or at least put that perspective into their mind on, hey, this is something you should think about in order to become a great athletic trainer, or something to be able to get better at becoming an athletic trainer? What would that be?
Tough thing. I think if I could, maybe it's take a little bit of a turn on that one, but student comes to me and says, like, I want to be in the profession. What should I do? What advice can you give? And I the first thing I say to them is, well, where do you want to be when you're 35, 40, 50 years old?
Mm-hmm.
How does your family play into it? And then I circle around to the demands of the position, the hours, the travel, the pay. Can you make that transition into having a family and a career? And I hate to say this, but it's a little different when I'm talking to a female athletic trainer.
Yeah. And why is that? Why?
I've always felt that the profession has not been kind to our female professional.
Mm-hmm.
It is so difficult to do the job and raise a family at the same time when you don't have that other significant other at home that might be able to do the things that you were doing as a young mom. That's sad, because in my career, I've seen so many outstanding female athletic trainers that couldn't stay in the profession. So I really, in either side, I'm talking about what does it look like for the future? And understanding the pitfalls of all the things we've talked about before, and saying, can you overcome it? What difference can you make in the profession so that you are making a good wage and a reasonable set of hours when you're not working 80 hours a week? And it's kind of the same thing that was said to me, you know, but do you have the fortitude to get through it and make it better? And I think that's what our profession needs, is those individuals that want to keep pushing the needle forward. I've done.
Yeah, no, I have to agree with that. I think that's the one reason why I didn't pursue, you know, a Division I or professional career was because of the being away from home, right? If for some reason something went sideways and my contract doesn't get renewed, where am I going next? You know, especially in pro sports, you just never know, right? There could be a whole managerial shift. And guess what? You're traveling somewhere, picking your family up. Not to say that it probably would have been rewarding. I think every job that you do in medicine is rewarding because that's why you do it. You do it because it makes a difference in that person's life every day. So for me, that's why I stuck with what I'm doing is, you know, I still work 12 to 14 hour days, but I'm at home every night, right? I can provide for my family. And it's just the way that I was brought up. I work and do my thing and I provide, and that's what I like to do every day. So for me, again, you talked about the female athletic trainer. If I was a female, how would that look? You know, I've seen some doors get open, like you said, or have definitely opened in the future. You know, this has changed over the past probably decade or so, but it's still a long way to go. But I feel like there's still that ability to have that balance in life. And it's tough in the profession just because of the way that the profession is.
It is. And I know it's changed a little bit, but not enough, in my opinion. I mean, you know, it's still talking, I'm sure you do, with so many athletic trainers that are in the high school, particularly the college level. And they're still at the mercy of the different coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, off-season sports, which are just going out of control.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
7 days a week, nights, weekends, holidays. And just, you can't raise a family. And I don't know if you agree with it, but I paid that price. Severely, you know, as a young, for a young family when I was at Babson. But I made that choice.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's, we have a lot of work to do. Let's put it that way. So hopefully any younger athlete trainers listening, we're handing the torch over. We're, you know, Chris is on his back like half a 18. He's like ready. He's almost done, but I got a little ways to go. But I think we have to advocate better for ourselves. And I know, you know, Jamie Musser and I are going to talk in a few weeks, and him and I have talked about this a lot. So hopefully we can figure out more of the legislative stuff, and more of the BOC stuff would be amazing to talk about.
I don't think I would agree with this, Andy, but it would be interesting to do a podcast or a panel discussion.
Yeah, I've thought about it.
Just on that topic alone, with it, you know, a mix of older, younger, mid-level, male, female athletic trainers to just get different perspectives.
Yeah, I thought of it because I want to get, again, like you and I talked about at the beginning, is that just the perspective about where do you think athletic training is going? How is it evolving? And also the demand, but also the education piece too. Like we talk about with PT going from a BS to an MS to a DPT. And athletic training now is following the same suit. But what does that mean? And how does that look? And Chad and I are going to talk too, because he runs the program at Ohio University. So him and I are going to get into the weeds, I think, on the education piece. So we're going to see what we can drag out of that conversation. So it should be a good one.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what he says on that one.
Yeah, it'd be great. Well, Chris, listen, I truly appreciate you coming out today. I know you're a busy guy, and you probably want to, you know, make sure you have a Datatherm for me when I need one in August. But again, thanks again, and I'll be in touch. I appreciate your time.
Andrew, thank you. Have a great day. And if you do need something, please let me know.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we're committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned for our next episode.